Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Connor Pierce here, student loan consultant. And today I'm joined by Jake Courtney, CFP and student loan consultant. Welcome to the show, Jake.
Happy to be here. Super excited to talk about this topic.
Jake and I have something in common here, and it's that we have both switched jobs. So this is one that we're both, you know, super passionate about. And we've both switched jobs while actually having student loans. So this podcast is really going to hit hard. Big surprise here. How to switch job with student loans, because you have to think about it differently when you're a student loan borrower, right? There's different things in the back of your mind, like how am I going to make that next payment? What do I do if my income goes down temporarily before it potentially goes up? Like maybe you're starting your own business. So really excited to talk through this with you, Jake, and just talk specifically to student loan borrowers about here's what you need to know.
That's right. Yeah. And switching jobs can be an extremely stressful time. There's just a lot of things to think about. So we're not only going to be talking about things you can do from the student loan front, but also diving in at a high level of other things to consider when it comes to switching jobs. At the end of the day, you're switching jobs for a reason, most likely to improve your life. Hopefully we'll help you simplify those decisions, because there's a lot to think about at the same time you're trying to get used to your new job if you've already made the switch, or you know, just dive into actually the work you're going to be doing.
Exactly right. You have to not only think about the financial implications, which is sometimes intimidating, like what all these different work benefits mean that I have right now or that I might have, like how do you put a numerical value on that? And then also, most importantly, like how does that fit into my lifestyle? Do I want to spend more time at home with a spouse or with kids or pursue that passion project that maybe you just don't feel like you have time or flexibility to do? So we're going to put some dollars and cents on that because that's what we love, right? We love numbers. We love student loans. We love the nuance of how do you take advantage of all these loopholes or potential things. So we're going to get in that, but also like take a step back, think big picture. How does this affect your life and where you're going? So let's start out and let's talk specifically about the student loan impact. Jake, just think about like, okay, I'm switching jobs. I'm going to do a little case study here, right? Because I like case studies, putting an actual person in front of you. So I'm a client and I'm saying, hey, I booked this call because I don't know what to do because I'm switching jobs and this new job that seems a little bit better for work-life balance, seems a little bit closer to home, is actually going to pay me less. Like, how am I going to handle this big student loan payment that I currently have? So what would you tell me?
It would be a case where you can actually save on your student loan payment. With federal student loans, if you're on an income-driven repayment plan, no matter which one you're on, whether it's save or pay-as-you-earn or IBR, whatever it might be, you always have the opportunity to recalculate your payment. And so even if your IDR anniversary date or your recertification date, sort of interchangeable terms there, isn't for another 6 months, if you suffer any sort of drop in income at a household level or your own individual level, you can go in and say, hey, my income has dropped. Here's my new income. Maybe if it's a new employer that's offering less income, maybe more benefits, but that's going to be later on in the pod here. But if there's less income and you have documentation of that, whether it's like your first pay stub at your new employer, you can have your servicer recalculate your income-driven repayment. So that can be a nice win when your income's going down and you can save a little bit on your student loan payment at the same time. The other thing too is that if there's a gap in employment too, so like let's say you don't start, say you're moving across the country and you don't start at your new employer for a solid 3 months or something like that, that's also another opportunity to recalculate your payment, because that is obviously a sudden drop in income because you're not receiving income for a certain period of time. So there's kind of a silver lining to making less income as a student loan borrower, especially you know, those that are on income-driven repayment plans.
Yeah. So here's what we're not saying. We're not saying you're way better off making less income, right? But we are saying there's this silver lining when you're looking to switch jobs. So if you're like, hey, I can't switch jobs because I'm going to make less money, and if that thought is attached to your student loan repayment per month, because you're like, this is just not in the budget, I can't afford $1,000, $2,000 payment because I'm going to take a pay cut. Guess what? You don't have to think about that because of these income-driven repayment plans, which make student loans so much more unique than any other type of debt. Now, that is not available if you have a private student loan. They're talking specifically about federal. But the crazy part, just like Jake said, is it doesn't matter what the reason is that you lost your income. Maybe you went part-time. Maybe you totally quit your job. You're totally burned out and you said, I'm done. I just need to get a mental break. If your income goes down, immediately you can go on. And there's so few people that know about this. and super advantageous when you're considering switching a job, making less income, whatever the reason is. Maybe your spouse makes less income and you're married filing jointly. That's another way that you can go on and immediately recertify your income. If your income goes down, recertify. Fun fact here too, if your income goes up, it doesn't catch back up to you to the next year. So it will catch up to you because you have to either use your tax return or report your current income. But if your income goes down, recertify immediately. If your income goes up, it'll catch back up to you the next year. So sounds like a loophole, perhaps is, but that's what we talk about here. We talk about putting you in the best situation for yourself and your family. So let's talk about another example here, Jake, too. And you talk to people about this fairly often, I know. So let's talk, you're in a PSLF qualifying job. So you're pursuing that 10 years of payments, 120 months worth, working full-time at a nonprofit or government entity, that is PSLF, and you're working towards forgiveness. Now, what do people specifically have to consider there if they're thinking about switching jobs? And maybe they're thinking about switching to a job that's no longer PSLF qualifying. So talk through an example there too.
Yeah. So we do this sort of analysis all the time for borrowers. We say, okay, what is your non-PSLF equivalent cost, right? So in terms of losing the PSLF benefit, typically the longer you have on that PSLF timeline, so like let's say you're at year one of PSLF out of 10 years, technically the trade-off between a private employer and a PSLF employer is actually less because you still have a solid 9 years to go of PSLF. So we'll take into consideration the total cost of PSLF, which because it's a tax-free forgiveness, it is purely just payments along the way is the total cost of PSLF with some income trajectories and things like that versus the non-PSLF forgiveness. So if you switch to a private employer and you're still a candidate for your typical income-driven repayment forgiveness, whether it's 20 years or 25 years, that's going to be taxable. So we kind of have to incorporate the total cost between the two, and we can compare those two, and we break down per year for the remainder of your PSLF timeline, how much per year that private employer would have to pay you extra in terms of after-tax compensation to make up for the fact that you're leaving PSLF. I think in general, and Connor, you might be able to speak to this, but in general, we find that when borrowers see the numbers between PSLF and non-PSLF, they tend to overweight the benefit of PSLF from a dollar standpoint compared to the private employer. And especially in maybe career paths where the PSLF employer might pay a lot less than a private employer. And sometimes I've had some borrowers say, oh, really? That's it? That's kind of what the private employer would have to pay to make up for the fact that I'm losing PSLF? I mean, have you had any recent borrowers kind of go through that sort of situation? And how did you go about, talking to them about that?
I did exactly what you did, Jake. So we map out, using some calculators, using some technology to say, okay, based on what your income might be, what does PSLF look like? How much is that going to save you? Because spoiler alert, if you're going to work at a nonprofit, PSLF is a really great option, super advantageous to many borrowers. There's not too many ways you're going to save more money as far as student loans. But you have to look holistically, right? You have to take a step back and say, what is the trade-off for working for a nonprofit? Because in many, if not most professions, if you're going to go work for that nonprofit hospital or that nonprofit or government entity, you're probably giving up a little bit of more salary on the table versus working for a private company or potentially even becoming a partner, which is a whole nother route. So you have to weigh those trade-offs. So looking at the numbers is super important. But just like you said, when we actually start comparing to folks who actually know the numbers of, well, if I can go make 40K more per year in a private sector as a physician, what does that look like overall as far as how much I'd save for PSLF? And if there is 5, 6, 7 years left after someone completes residency and fellowship, that's the client that I'm picturing in my head. Someone I saw 2 weeks ago was a psychiatrist, and she was like, well, I need to do PSLF to get the rest of this forgiven, because I've already got all these years from residency, she was doing a fellowship, and she was only going to have like 4 more years left. But then when we weighed those 4 years versus her actually having her own private practice, it actually made no sense to go the PSLF route, because she could make that much more at a private company, which was a for-profit. She could substantially out-earn that. And then in that case, it was actually, oh, I'm definitely going private, because now I can work anywhere I want. I can make my own hours. I don't have to be full-time. So again, better for her life and actually better for her finances when she actually booked the call at the beginning to say, hey, I want to figure this out because I want to make sure I'm doing PSLF right. And then it was a total switch to say, oh my gosh, I can do whatever I want. So again, relating it back to the big picture is so important.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's kind of break down some numbers here. So like hypothetically, if somebody was at 6 years in the PSLF, they had 4 years to go, like your case here, and they could make 40K at a private employer, ignoring taxes, ignoring inflation and everything like that. But 40K times 4 years is $160,000 more in compensation compared to the PSLF employer. If the cost of PSLF is 160K or more, less than the non-PSLF forgiveness. Otherwise, you know, we're talking about a break-even analysis here. So the PSLF savings would have to be at least 160K for that to be an equivalent situation. If that borrower had 9 years to go times 40, that's $360,000 savings of PSLF versus non-PSLF. And if somebody has 200K of student loans, I doubt that the savings is going to be that tremendous of $360,000. So in that case, that, like I mentioned before, the longer you have for the PSLF timeline to go, typically the break even is actually much less than you might think.
Yeah. One word that we use in the finance world, right, is called like the sunk cost fallacy of like, sometimes you get like so attached to, oh, I've already put this many years into PSLF. I kind of have to stay the course, right? Like you're like afraid to give up what you've already like committed to. But then if you kind of like start right now, today, and you project it out, you're like, no, like you did do that and that's okay. But if we like make the best decision for you starting today, we shouldn't be thinking about what happened in the past. We should think about moving forward. And that's how we look at that. And yeah, like sometimes people's shoulders literally like go down on the call and they're like, oh my gosh, like I actually have options. I'm not cornered into this job that maybe I don't love as much as I thought I would. And I'm not stuck here for another 4 or 5 years or even 9 years because that just sat in their head for some reason. PSLF, that's going to save me all this money. I have to do it. And that's often not the case. So let's talk a little bit too, when we're talking about income changes. So sometimes your income goes up when you go, sometimes it goes down. Let's talk a little bit about how we might think about income and relative to like the total number of hours, right? Because when you think about your salary, that's an important thing to think about. But then when you think about, maybe I have to commute a little bit extra to this new job or to this old job, like what if your commute is 20, 30 minutes more each way every single day? Like, how do you think about that at an hourly rate? Because I often think about, well, what could I be doing with that hour? Could I be making an extra $200 an hour? And if I add that up 5 days a week, that's $1,000 a week. And if I'm doing that for 48 weeks a year, now we're talking about a pretty significant chunk of change because I could be using that hour somewhere else. Or even more importantly, at least importantly to me, I could be spending that hour with family. Like, what is the value of that? Like, that's hard to put a dollar amount
on. Or you could be sleeping in.
Sleeping is a huge thing. I have a 3 and a 1 year old, and I know you have a young one too, Jake. Sleep is invaluable, right? It makes you perform at a higher level. We could go on a whole talk about that. But yeah, like the trade-off of hourly compared to compensation. And let's just talk a little bit about that when we're talking about switching jobs as well.
Yeah. To bake it down to some very basic numbers here, if you take your total annual comp and you get it down to an hourly pay rate, even if you're paid on a production or a salary base or something like that, you know, it doesn't really matter what kind of comp you receive, just total comp, and you get that down to your hourly rate and you say, okay, if I'm spending an extra 30 minutes one way to my new employer and then 30 minutes back. And of course, you know, if you're on the East Coast or on the West Coast in the LA area, I mean, that can be 30 minutes to an hour or 2 hours, depending on what traffic looks like and the time of day, you know. But if you bake that down into those numbers and say, okay, if my compensation at my new employer doesn't at least make up for the extra time spent commuting, then just flat out, it doesn't really make any sense at that standpoint, because you're right. You're taking time away from your family. You're taking away time from your sleep, which could, of course, improve your job performance and your satisfaction if you sleep more. So, you know, you just kind of have to bake it down into your hourly rate. And some borrowers that are with us have a very high hourly rate for the compensation they're receiving. And, you know, that can be substantial, even if it's a 30-minute extra commute there.
And to even go one step further, right? Like, taxes are a thing. No matter what you do, you're going to have to pay taxes. So maybe your hourly rate is really high, but maybe you're actually losing a good chunk of that because you're in a higher tax bracket. Maybe you're the government is taking 35, 40% of that amount. So then it's like, okay, well, is it really worth it? Or maybe even scaling back hours, different things like that, all to think about. So let's talk about just a little tip on like negotiation. So if you were a graduate loan borrower, which most of our listeners have some sort of graduate degree, that's why they racked up all this student debt, right? So they could get a good job, they could work in a highly skilled profession that required a graduate degree, but a bunch of student debt came with that. So one thing we know about student loan borrowers who have a graduate degree is the unemployment rate is very, very low. So again, with the thought of, oh my gosh, what if I switch jobs? Like what's going to happen? And this obviously depends. Like if you're a really, really niche specific specialty, maybe there's a little bit less opportunity, but the chances overall that you are going to be unemployed for a long period of time are very low. So like I think about kind of the fear mongering, well, it's not that great here at this job, but what if it's even worse at the next one? Well, I'd change that question, say, what if it's even better? And you know what? Guess what? If it's not even better, it's like horrible. You can always switch back because what is it? Like, what are the stats, Jake? I can't remember the exact percentage. I want to say less than like 2 or 3% as far as like if you have a graduate degree, a doctorate level, or even like a master's or beyond, your unemployment rate is almost non-existent.
Yeah. I'm looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics here. Not to sound too nerdy, but yeah, doctoral degree unemployment rates in 2023 is 1.6%. And even just in general, even if you don't have a doctoral degree, if you're just looking for a job that with a master's degree or something like that, it's still way less than the general population. And so with your lower unemployment rate, you tend to have a little bit more bargaining chips when you come to the table, right, with your new employer or maybe your prospective employer in terms of bargaining compensation, bargaining other benefits, other bonuses, work hours. Because when the unemployment rate in general, just overall in the US in the past 2 or 3 years has been under 4%. Now I think it's just at 4%. So it's going up just a little bit. But when it's this low, the workers tend to have a little bit more weight when it comes to these negotiations because the supply and demand of those workers are a little bit of imbalanced.
100%. And the other way that I think about compensation, so many people are really focused on salary. And that's obviously important, right? Whatever your hourly salary rate is going to have a big impact on you. But one of my favorite things to negotiate too is different things like some of the fringe benefits is, hey, well, what if you can get them to offer a little bit more in Con Ed because you know you're going to be working towards some special certification or something like that, that you're like, hey, you know, whatever amount that you offer is not going to cover that. Because at the end of the day, that's still part of your compensation package. So sometimes if they're like, hey, we're not budging on salary, this is all we can give you, you're a new grad or you only have this much experience or we're a nonprofit and it's pretty fixed, try and negotiate some of those other things that are important to you that you know will ultimately still give you a bigger value overall, because sometimes there is a little bit of wiggle room with some of those other types of benefits.
And most likely, the worst case scenario is they say, no, we can't do that. And then you take the job anyway that you were going to anyway. Or you can move to, you know, start negotiating with another employer. It's a lot of upside and virtually no downside.
I've never heard of a case where someone has lost a job because they said, hey, can you meet me here? Or can you offer more? Or, hey, I got an offer from Hospital B down the street. Can you match that? And my wife has done that before. You know, she's a PT. My past career was PT, and she actually did that. She had offer A and offer B. She really wanted to go to offer B because it seemed like a better fit for her. And offer A gave her a higher salary, 10% higher salary. So guess what? She went back. She had the awkward 5-minute phone call of, hey, I'd love to work for you. And she was very polite about it, but also straightforward and said, but I got an offer for this. Can you match it? And guess what? 5 awkward minutes turned into a 10% increase on her salary as a new grad. So sometimes it's worth the awkwardness. You know, it's obviously a case-by-case basis, but 5 minutes of awkwardness and a weekend of waiting, right? Like we also were like, oh, I'm like, you feel weird about it. But at the same time, you know, you should be able to ask for what you're worth, right? And sometimes we all have a problem with that. At least many folks have a problem with really asking for what they deserve or what they're worth. So there's just a cool real life example for me where 10% increase is a pretty big deal because now you're getting raises off of that year over year while you're there. So the ROI on that was insane on an hourly basis, right?
Yeah. And it really helps if you have an existing offer from another prospective employer, because when they see that, or you have proof of that, that makes it even more credible when you're coming to the negotiating table.
Absolutely. So we talked a little bit about compensation. We talked about how that affects student loan borrowers. Let's talk about retirement. We love talking about retirement, right? Who doesn't like thinking about retirement, right? Whether you're like 1 year into your profession or you've been in there for like 20 years, it's fun to think about retirement and just more than retirement, total flexibility. So what are some things you should be thinking about if you're thinking, okay, what does retirement look like for me? And what are these benefits that the company offers? How should you be thinking about that when you're switching jobs?
Yeah. So before you actually make the decision to switch, one thing to definitely focus on, or at least look into, is something called your vesting schedule with your existing employer. So with your 401k, 403b, everything you contribute to those retirement plans will automatically be 100% vested, meaning that it's yours when you leave the employer. But the employer matches, the employer contributions might have a vesting schedule to where if you leave the employer before a certain amount of time, usually it's service years, that's basically, you know, a sunk cost, right? So you could be leaving a couple thousand or tens of thousands of dollars of employer matches that have accumulated over the years. You could be leaving that with your old employer. And therefore, you know, you have to kind of consider that with the total compensation increase or, you know, in perspective of the whole thing there. Now, it might totally be worth it at the next employer if you do lose, you know, the employer matches, or at least a portion of the employer matches, but definitely something to consider. And then the other thing to consider too is, does your new employer offer a retirement benefit? Because if they don't, then you might be fairly limited as a W-2 employee in terms of ways that you can make tax deductible contributions to retirement account, right? You could pretty much be stuck to a traditional IRA, which is only $7,000 a year that you can put in and you can offset your taxable income, right? So that's another big factor too. Now, sometimes you will be offered a 1099 position. So Connor, I don't know if you had experience talking to borrowers with the 1099 versus W-2 relationship there, but tell me a little bit about kind of the big differences between the two, or some things to think about if you're offered kind of like maybe one employer with a 1099 relationship versus a W-2 over here.
So with 1099 versus W-2, retirement is part of the conversation. So it kind of leads into one of the big pieces if you're a 1099 versus a W-2 is, you know, if you're 1099, you don't really have an employer. You are a contractor. So you can have your own type of retirement plan. And that usually involves a little bit of back-end paperwork and figuring that out, doing things like potentially a solo 401k. So if you have an employer, you can do a 401k. If you're a contractor or you have your own business, you could do things like a solo 401k. But that's one of the big differences off the cuff.
And what's the big benefit to a solo 401k? How much can you put into a solo 401k versus even if you were an employee offered a 401k?
Yeah, so let's talk about, I guess, first maybe W-2, because that's maybe the more common one. So if you're W-2, you can put for 2024, I believe it's $23,000 as the employee. So as an employee, you can put $23,000 in, and then maybe your employer will match that and add like a little bit more. But that's how much you can put in, deducts your adjusted gross income, which again, is a super important number, because for student loan borrowers, it not only lowers your amount that you pay in taxes at the end of the year, so you save money on taxes, it also lowers your student loan payment in an income-driven repayment plan. So a great way to do that as a W-2. As a contractor or self-employed person, you can do a solo 401k. Now, again, you can still put that $23,000 in order to, you know, lower your taxable income. But if you own your own business, you can do both the employee and the employer match, which can get you potentially up to like $69,000. And is that number correct there? But it is also based off a formula that they use. So why don't you jump into the formula there, Jake, on how you can potentially calculate it?
So at a very high level, you are limited to the employer contributions to the account. You're matching yourself technically. Now, don't quote me on this, but I believe it's about 25% of your net self-employment income is how much you can match yourself as the employer. So you'd have to make a solid income to be able to put the full $69,000 in there. But if you're at a very high tax rate, even from like your state income tax side of things, plus your 10% technical student loan tax, that can be a substantial ROI in terms of getting to be able to put in another $30,000, $40,000 into your tax deductible retirement plan, right? So if we think about what you're doing is you're trying to lower your lifetime taxes, and this might be one of the highest earning years in the rest of your life. And so it would make a lot of sense to deduct your taxable income this year, especially with student loans, versus you'll be taxed on the withdrawal there. So yeah, it's one of the closest things to free lunches in terms of tax deductibility. You don't have to spend money to get the deductions. You're investing those dollars that'll turn into maybe $8 later on.
So 1099 versus W-2, that's one of the big differences is retirement. And again, you have to get that retirement plan. You don't just magically have it. Like you have to do a little bit of paperwork to get the solo 401k. That's something that we do with a financial advising firm called SLP Wealth is we actually help folks to do that who are a 1099 or are self-employed. So really important to understand that. Some of the other benefits you give up if you're talking, I'm going to be W-2 versus 1099 is different things like healthcare benefits, right? Different things like some of the PTO, right? Like if you're self-employed, you can take as much PTO as you want technically, but you're not going to get paid for it versus you are getting paid for that as a W-2. So again, thinking through that decision, there's really three different avenues. We talked about like full-time, which is like W-2 versus self-employed, 1099, or sometimes people will call that PRN, right? Like as needed, you make your own hours, you work for someone else, but kind of in between that is this part-time. So when we're thinking about benefits, oftentimes if it's a company that you have an option to maybe be full-time, part-time, or PRN, different tiers of the way they'll treat your benefits will also come into play. So if you're full-time, you probably get the best benefits. You get a better retirement. You get more PTO days. You probably pay less as far as the portion that's coming out of your paycheck towards your health insurance, which is a big deal, right? If you're part-time, oftentimes you might get some of those benefits, but you might not. And that's going to be company dependent because some will still give you healthcare benefits, even if you're only 20 hours a week. Other companies are going to say, no, that costs us a lot. We're not going to do that. And then the same way if you're PRN, occasionally companies, it's not super common, will actually still allow you to be on their health insurance, which can save you some money versus going to the marketplace if you're 1099 or you're self-employed. But really important, again, to weigh all of those different avenues of full-time, part-time, PRN to figure out what's the best combination of this to get the max return as far as your job when you think about all those fringe benefits.
Yeah, 100%. And I think as you're kind of shifting from maybe an employer that's offered all of those benefits to maybe a 1099 relationship, there's something from a health insurance perspective called COBRA that you'll have the option to be able to utilize, which is basically replicating your old employer's health insurance, which I think it's 18 months, Connor, is that right? Where you can be on your old employer's health insurance?
I can't say for certain exactly how long it is, but one of the unique things about COBRA, because I actually did COBRA. So I did COBRA for about a 3-month time period when I was transitioning jobs. And the reason why I did that is this, is we had already hit our out-of-pocket, our deductible for the year. So the rest of the healthcare was going to be pretty much covered, whatever myself, my wife, and our two kids used. So it was like, hey, I'm willing to pay a little bit extra because here's the way it typically works. If you're a full-time employee, you're paying a portion of the health insurance, your employer is paying the other. So like in our example, I think I was paying like $600 or some a month, every single month towards health insurance, and my employer was covering about $600 or $700. Well, guess what? Once I switched jobs, I could still have the exact same health insurance plan, but I had to cover both portions. So now our health insurance bill was like $1,200, $1,300 a month because we were covering both of the premiums, right? So again, as you switch, it was advantageous for us because all the rest of the healthcare was free because we already hit our deductible. But the downside to it was we're also paying more for this health insurance. And that's the same way it works. If you're self-employed, you're going to be on the hook for the entire cost of whatever that healthcare is.
Right. And the other alternative, just to touch on this really quick, is the ACA health insurance, ACA marketplace plans, which I'm personally using that right now. And I've found that it's, while in practice, you can see certain costs, it tends to be very convoluted in sort of finding out which provider is covered. And they tend to be HMO plans, which you have to use your primary care physician to refer out to every single specialist you go to. And the other thing too, is that most of the plans on the ACA marketplace have a deductible, but then after the deductible is met, typically have like a 25% coinsurance on top of it. So once you hit your deductible, you're not done at that point. So you tend to still have to pay with a large out-of-pocket max on the ACA marketplace plan. So typically COBRA tends to make a lot of sense compared to the ACA plans out there.
Yeah, and that's a good thing to point out. So circling back to probably one more point that I forgot to mention with W-2 versus contractor or 1099 work is the payroll tax. So payroll tax is a combination of Medicare and FICA. So if you're a W-2 employee, your company is paying a portion of that tax. So the tax altogether is a little bit more than 15%. But if you're employed as a W-2 employee, your company is covering half of that, so about 7.6. If you are a contractor or self-employed, you have to cover 7.6, a little more than 7.6, for both you and the employer. So you're going to get a little bit more of a tax hit. You're going to have to pay a little bit more in taxes. Maybe some of you have heard, oh my gosh, you have to pay so much in taxes if you're self-employed. That is true, but then you also have to weigh that versus different things that you can maybe write off, which can lower your taxable income. So again, really important to run the numbers if you're going to make that leap. And the other thing is when you're self-employed, the more write-offs and things you have, and this is especially true if you're starting a new business, there's a lot of overhead oftentimes between maybe purchasing a practice or purchasing equipment to start that practice or technology, whatever it is. Those can all lower your income on paper, which is what the government cares about, which again circles back to that first point we made about now your income on paper is lower, which means your student loan payment can be lower. So a lot of factors to weigh, but really important to know the trade-offs. Don't just kind of take it for its word of like, oh, if you're self-employed, you have to pay way more in taxes, or you don't have any of those benefits, that's going to cost you an arm and a leg. That might be true, but there's also ways that you can balance that and maybe mitigate it so that you have that kind of moment where it's like, oh, maybe this isn't as different as I thought it would be.
Yeah, you're right. So let's kind of cap this off with just a rapid fire of a couple more benefits to talk about, and then we'll kind of cap off the pod here. So real quick, we can kind of group these together a little bit, but disability and life insurance, kind of thinking about the difference. If you're going from a W-2 position that offered disability and life insurance to a 1099 position at another employer, well, if that's an employer-sponsored disability and life insurance policy, you lost it. Typically, you lost it when you left the employer. Now, sometimes on the life insurance front, you can convert that to your own individual policy. But in general, you don't really have as much coverage as you would if you just purchased an individual policy. Most of the borrowers we work with are they're highly skilled workers, and disability insurance tends to be one of the biggest risk mitigators that we have available to us, because we spend all this time going through graduate school, medical school, et cetera, a lot of time and effort invested in your individual skills. Well, if you become disabled and you're not able to perform your job function, well, that's a huge kind of sunk cost in the form of schooling and in student loan payments, et cetera. And the disability insurance typically is best if you get an individual disability policy that's own occupation, which basically means that if you're disabled and you're not able to do your own specific job, even if you're able to do another job, it will still pay out that benefit. And same with life insurance, and your own individual life insurance policy tends to be a lot better because it doesn't matter which employer you're with. You'll still be covered if you're with your own individual policy.
And circling back to that point, you don't want to be stressed about, oh my gosh, I got to go figure out life insurance. I got to go figure out disability insurance because I don't have a plan if I leave this employer. That's just like another thing that's going to be holding you back from thinking about all the other things that we just talked about. Do I have a better work-life balance if I switch? Do I have, you know, a better opportunity for maybe more income growth or maybe just more professional growth if I switch jobs? You do not want to be thinking about some of these things like, oh shoot, well, if I stop and I don't start a new job right away, I'm going to be totally out of life insurance or totally out of disability insurance for whatever that gap period is, or even health insurance. So thinking about these things in advance, just go get that policy. Make sure that everyone is like taken care of if something happens to you. And fun fact for males in their 20s and 30s, right? So I remember there's a stat, you're 5 times more likely to become disabled than to pass away. And guess what? If you become disabled or you have like a complete disability, you can no longer work, you are still incurring a lot of expenses, right? Because of healthcare and all those different things. So disability insurance, I find, is sometimes actually left out more than life insurance. But in reality, for a lot of folks, that's probably the bigger one to cover, just to make sure you're taken care of, or your family, whoever else is there, is going to be taken care of if something happens to you. So Jake, we've covered a lot of ground here, right? Between benefits, between what to consider if you have student loans. What's the last thing you want to leave with our audience today?
I would just say, just in general, student loans, especially federal student loans, don't have to be this giant weight that steers your decision with switching jobs. They're very flexible. We can always recalculate your payment, especially if your income drops, but they don't have to be the super stressful kind of component to your decision. And the other thing I would say is run your numbers. if you can translate the employee benefits into dollar amounts, that's also going to help you kind of see the spreadsheet decision behind it. So those two things, the student loans don't have to be stressful. And then also just know your numbers, run your numbers when you're contemplating a job change or starting your own business. Those are the two things that I would think are the most valuable as you're going through this transition.
I love that. Know your numbers so you can make a good decision. And also, don't be so stressed about student loans, because maybe there's some options that you aren't aware of. And hopefully we brought light to that today. But if you're saying, hey, I need to know my numbers, I need to know exactly what this looks like on paper, we would love to help you out. Either Jake, myself, or one of our other student loan consultants would love to help you. Go to studentloanplanner.com/book. We can find those numbers out for you, and we can help you to make a good decision. Should you take that other job? Should you stay where you're at? Maybe you want to start your own business. And we would love to be a part of that so you can make the best decision for your future. Thanks for hanging out, and have a great week.